This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 13th, 2013. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. This week, the tax impact of repeal replace. The developments this week will include a discussion of that very issue. The House committees began their markup of the American Health Care Act that has various tax provisions. We'll also talk about a couple of other developments. We have the abode issue, trips up a taxpayer who is working abroad. And we have the First Circuit Court of Appeals decides that we couldn't quite go as far as a taxpayer wanted to go, and this was a receiver for a taxpayer who had taken over an organization where the original organization had received money that was deemed to be by fraud and was going to have to pay that back. Of course, they don't really have the money. That's part of the problem. That's why we have a receiver. The receiver tried to use claim of right to get back the federal taxes they had paid. First Circuit decided that wasn't going to work. We'll discuss that. Well, this is the last time I get to remind you that we're coming up on the first change due dates. Well, we have the March 15th dates coming up. So please remember, this week you're doing your extensions. Partnerships and S corporations are the ones with the March 15th due date. C corporations' due dates have moved back to April 15th. Obviously, the biggest risk in this week are the partnerships because many of them may not realize that their due date has changed. So you want to make sure you don't let any of those slip basically between the cracks because you normally didn't worry about them for a while. Also, remember that our C corps moved back. Don't forget, though, that many states are still working on conforming to these date changes. So you may very well have a C corporation that has a extended due date of April 15th, you know, or I should say an original due date of April 15th federally. But if the state law hasn't changed, you may very well find the state law date still is March 15th, so you may need a state extension in place, even though you don't need to worry about a federal one for another month. So all that great fun, our first due date, key due date of the year, and it also marks, as always, 1 month until the big due date. Well, not quite, actually a little more than a month because the big due date is going to be on the 18th, but we have another month, so the end of tax season now is approaching us. In essence, the part of tax season gets really messy is just about upon us. But let's go ahead and take a look at the developments for this week. And we're going to start with the introduction of the American Health Care Act. The bill was posted on Monday for markup. So we got markup versions of the bill posted on Monday of last week. That bill for markup text, that had the basic outline of what the repeal and replace program would actually contain, at least the initial draft of what that would contain. So it gives us our thoughts on how this is going to go forward. Now, one thing to remember before we get started with this is that this is only a proposed bill. You should not go and assume that the provisions of this bill will become law. While I expect it does contain the outline of what will become law if we do get something, and again, most likely we will get it, but we'll talk a little bit about some of the challenges it's going to face to get there. But it doesn't mean the details that we're going to talk about here are going to survive and be the details in the final bill. These may be changed, tweaked, some things may be radically redone before we get to a final bill, but at least gives you an idea of where things are going. The committee hearings took place on March the 8th, including one in the House Ways and Means Committee that we're interested in, because that's going to talk about the tax-related aspects of this bill. And that bill in the House Ways and Means Committee, where we talk about the tax-related aspects of the bill, that particular, you know, meeting didn't really produce any changes. It took a long time, as I recall, about 18 hours. There were tons of amendments offered and turned down. It was kind of a show by the Democrats of their opposition to the bill. So for all those reasons, it took a while, but nevertheless, the bill did come out of committee. On the website, we have now, in addition to the bill that I placed up there that was ready for markup, the version that came out on Monday, we now do have the more updated, cleaned up version that was posted later in the week on the Ways and Means site. So I have access to that. You want to download that. You'll find the links to that on the website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, in the article on the American Health Care Act. and you'll find it in the PDF for this week. Now, the bill now heads this week to the House Budget Committee, where there'll be more hearings there. This is part of the reconciliation process, remember, so that's why it's part of the budget process. So it has to run through the Budget Committee. The Speaker of the House hopes to bring this to a vote the week of the 20th on the, at the House floor. So presumably before the end of March, the House would have acted on this, and then the matter goes over to the U.S. Senate. On the Senate side, it's a little messier, because on the Senate side, presuming the Democrats all vote against it, and that seems to be a very safe assumption at this point, then the Republican majority in the House can only lose two senators' votes and still pass the bill. Since there are 52 Republican senators, if they lost, if two voted no, then we would have a 50-50 tie. In that case, Vice President Pence could cast the vote that would take it over the top. The problem we have at this point is, by my count, at least six senators have voiced some problems or severe reservations with the bill. Now, some of them have not yet said they would vote against it. But the more disconcerting matter of with those six is those six don't agree on what the problem is. And in fact, the solution for one group of them, the ones that are concerned about the reduction in Medicaid, where their states have gone into the Medicaid program and went with the Medicaid expansion program, to solve them would be to continue that program or to expand it out longer. If you do that, you're going to run into objections with the other senators who object to the cost and, in fact, not just killing the whole Medicare expansion right away, as well as, you know, having various other items in this bill rather than doing a straight repeal. So the Senate could be more interesting. However, since virtually every Republican ran on a repeal of the Obamacare program, it seems likely that they'll pass something. Otherwise, it would seem like that's going to be a major negative black mark on inability to deliver. So we'll have to see what they do. With that, we're going to assume that this bill, to the extent we've got it, as like the Wall Street Journal said in their editorial, this is basically the only option you're going to have. So, you know, just, you know, essentially the Wall Street Journal's theory was to just, you know, bite your tongue and pass it, was their advice to the Republicans in Congress. We'll see if that advice is followed. Let's talk about what's in this bill. Now, what's more interesting in some ways is what's not in the bill. The bill does not repeal the Cadillac tax. That's that tax on too generous of healthcare benefits. Now, it doesn't repeal it, but it yet again pushes it back. And so I'm going to say in a practical sense, I think really it is repeal. By that, I mean, actually, I think we repealed it when we talked about the 2012 Act that kicked it back. So I should say, the Act in 2015 that kicked the due date back, the effective date. When Congress starts kicking effective dates back on provisions that nobody likes, that's usually a sign that they want to repeal it, but they don't want to take the budget hit. They want to make the numbers look good when they score the bill for budget purposes. So we just don't want to admit that we're not going to have that revenue. So I suspect that is true here. They want to pick this revenue up in 2025 now to make the bill look good. And then that still gives them a number of years before for them to come back and either push it back again, which unfortunately may be the most likely option because that'll keep the budget cost of getting rid of it lower, or actually bite the bullet and repeal it. The other thing not in this bill, which had been discussed quite a bit, but didn't show up there, and in fact, we saw a preview of it in the bill at the end of the year that solved the problem for private health insurance reimbursement for small employers. Remember there was a cap on the maximum amount that an employer could exclude under that program. Many people thought that was a precursor to having that put generally in the repeal replace bill. There's nothing in this bill limiting the amount that an employer can exclude from the W-2 income of an employee. So we don't. So that is not in this for providing health care. So that provision also is not in this bill. What is in the bill, though, first, most importantly, probably for many of us, the net investment income tax will be repealed effectively for tax years beginning after 2017. So it doesn't help you for this year. So the 2017, the net investment income tax will still be in place. It will still apply to clients. But if this bill passes in its current form, the tax would disappear after this year. Another thing that happens here is, and this one is brand new, we get a brand new age-adjusted tax credit to provide for the purchase of health insurance. This is meant to take over and substitute for the credit that we had under the Affordable Care Act that was used to subsidize health insurance for those who had unaffordable offerings of coverage. Under the Affordable Care Act, you may remember, the way this works is that you get a credit that ensures that you're not required to pay more than some percentage of your household's income to acquire a policy with a certain minimum amount of benefits. It was a silver policy, the second lowest cost silver policy available in your area. So that was the idea of this program. Under the new bill, we're going to change that. We are going to offer an age-based credit. This would recognize the fact that insurance tends to get more costly as you get older. The credit would start out for those under age 30 would be $2,000. For those in their 30s, they would get a $2,500 credit. Those in their 40s get a $3,000 credit. Those in their 50s would get a $3,500 credit. And those in their 60s would get a $4,000 credit. As originally envisioned, this credit would be available to everyone regardless of income. Unfortunately, it turns out when they started looking at the budget numbers, that wasn't going to work. They either had to reduce the credit so much it would have been irrelevant, or they have to get rid of it at income levels. So this will phase out as your income gets above certain levels. In fact, you'll lose $100 of credit for each $1,000 in income above the phase-out caps. For those who are filing jointly, the phase-out begins at $150,000. For those who are filing as single, the phase out begins at $75,000, single head of household. Now, families are allowed to combine the credits for the various members. So you could take a 20-year-old, let's say one spouse is 20, the other is 30, one spouse, let's say, is 28, the other spouse is 32. They could get a $4,500 credit. Then you could add your kids in at $2,000 apiece because they're under age 30. But the maximum that a family could end up getting under the program would be $14,000. So no more than 14 absolute credit. And that credit, by the way, is not modified no matter how old mom and dad are. The credit's going to be at $14,000 for a family. Also, individuals that have access to government health insurance or employer-provided health insurance would not be eligible for the credit. And the credit would be both refundable and advanceable. And Treasury is going to have to design a program to cover this. Now, the reason why they wanted a $2,000 to $4,000 credit with no income limitation was to get rid of the hassle that we have right now of having to get the IRS involved and having to get Treasury handling all these computations for how much you could give somebody. But unfortunately, that's not going to go away with this bill. It will change. It'll be definitely be different. But Treasury is still going to be involved in determining how much of a credit, how much of a subsidy you can get. Now, the ACA-style credit will not immediately disappear, but it will be radically changed. For the next 2 years, a couple of changes will take place. So for 18 and 19. First thing is, we would get rid of the cap on how much of the advance credit you have to repay. Under the Affordable Care Act, remember, there were limitations. If you got more credit than you should have, under the Affordable Care Act, there was a cap on how much of that you had to repay that was based on your income. That cap would disappear entirely under this change. So for 18 and 19, if you got too much in advance credit under the ACA style credit, you have to pay the whole amount back. Secondly, we're no longer going to subsidize the second lowest cost silver policy. Rather, the subsidy will only come into play for catastrophic health plans only. So presumably we keep the same percents of income limitations, but we're only going to basically subsidize catastrophic style plans. So that would be the limit. So the ACA credit, and then it will disappear in 2020 in any event. Now, the other big thing is that we're going to have a removal of the shared responsibility payment. So the shared responsibility payment this is for both employers and employees, would be repealed effective immediately. So for 2017, it wouldn't exist. And the bill provides penalty relief for 2016. So that's useful. The bill does contain a replacement for the adverse selection problem. That is, because we're still going to say insurers cannot deny coverage due to pre-existing conditions. Under the new bill, if you have not maintained continuous coverage, an insurer can charge you a 30% higher premium when you try to come get insurance from them. That's supposed to make up and give you the incentive to stay in if you're young and healthy and continue to have coverage so you don't get hit with that 30% surcharge. Finally, health savings account rules would be changed and expanded. Spouses could make catch-up contributions. The contribution limits would be increased to $6,550 for individuals and $13,100 for families. HSA funds could go back to being used to purchase over-the-counter drugs. Remember, that was a change that came in with the ACA. And finally, the additional tax on the use of funds for non-medical expenses would be put back to the 10% it used to be at, rather than having the higher penalty rate we have today. Now, again, all of this is, basically going before us right now. So we'll have to see how it goes through the House and Senate. But at least you'll have some idea about the ideas Congress is considering for these bills. Now let's move on to our developments this week. The first development we have is a case Locke versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2017-10. This came out on March 6th. Mr. Lark, he worked overseas mainly in Iraq, but he did have one short assignment in Israel. He was outside the country for almost all the year. He'd come back every so often, but he was over there for the vast majority of time. And he would meet, as we may be aware, if there's a foreign tax credit, there is the physical presence test that'll test how many days you're over there. Well, he was over there more than enough days for that, so he filed a Form 2555, claimed the foreign earned income exclusion. So he could exclude from his wages, or exclude from his taxes, his income, wages that he had earned overseas up to the maximum amount allowed for the exclusion. Now, he seemed to meet many of the requirements. First thing is, he didn't fall into the trap we've talked about before, where you have somebody merely working in international areas, such as international airspace. We have a case, Lee Turnell versus Commissioner from 2012, I'll mention in the write-up, you'll see, or when they were international waters. That was a Wilson case from last year. Nor was he an employee of the U.S. government agency, which was the problem we had in the Dinger case in 2015. But Mr. Locke had a problem under IRC Section 911D, specifically D3. Under D3, you must have a tax home outside the United States, which is important. Normally, tax home means your principal place of business, but D3 adds additional requirement. For purposes of the foreign earned income exclusion, an individual shall not be treated as having a tax home in a foreign country for any period where his abode within the United States. Now, neither the code nor regulation define what is an abode, but the courts do. And as the court pointed out in this case, this particular, in a domestic commutation, is different than their place of business. It's kind of where you have your family home, let's say your personal home, where you have family, economic, and personal ties, where are your domestic ties. That is where your abode is. In this case, Mr. Locke could not establish that he had an abode in either Iraq or Israel. In fact, his facility in Iraq was a converted storage bin. It was kind of a storage container, was converted. So they put that into two pieces, very temporary type of structure. They pointed out his family and personal ties stayed with the United States. His wife and the son lived in Florida, even though the marriage was falling apart and Mrs. Locke would eventually divorce him. Doesn't matter. By the way, interestingly enough, she also got innocent spouse relief from this assessment. So Mr. Locke, he ended up with double bad news. And he took his family on vacations when he was not working overseas. He maintained his status as a reserve deputy sheriff in Florida. He owned and helped to manage three rental properties. and he owned and he organized and served as a resident agent for three startup businesses. He had financial affairs were managed through personal business bank accounts in Florida. He didn't really have any tie to Iraq except his work for his employer. You know, he spent lots of time there and he probably developed bonds with his coworkers. They said that wasn't really what he was considering home, that all of his true major ties were back home. He merely was, you know, dealt with those people because he had worked with those people. And so because of that, he was on visas of limited duration, didn't pursue any business opportunities in Iraq, didn't have his banking in Iraq, didn't purchase property there, and had very austere living quarters. For that reason, the court determined, since his abode had not left the United States, he could not claim the foreign earned income exclusion. So tough luck for poor Mr. Locke. Finally, the case of Rob Evans and Associates versus United States. Rob Evans and Associates were the receivers who took over an organization that had lost a court case where they had been found guilty of defrauding customers. They had basically, claimed to provide assistance to financially strapped individuals. Turned out, we determined eventually through the suits, et cetera, it was finally held that they had obtained the funds under fraudulent means. They had obtained them through what looked to be not-for-profit organizations, but had really been funneling money to the for-profit in the view of the court. Therefore, there was a judgment award against this organization to have to repay what it had fraudulently obtained. Now, of course, the organization, and it was, you know, it was financially not really able to do that. A receiver was appointed to attempt to help these people collect their claim because there was this claim against the company. The receiver, noting that the for-profit entity it now taken over had paid tax on the amounts it had gotten fraudulently, said, "Oh no, we can go ahead and we can do a we're going to file for a refund of those federal taxes on a claim of right." Now, claim of right generally is when somebody obtains funds, has funds, which they have an unrestricted right to use, and then later have to repay those funds. The case we most often see, somebody gets a signing bonus for, you know, taking a new position, but the bonus says, "I'm going to give you $100,000, but if you don't work for us for 3 years, you have to pay us back that $100,000. Well, you pick up the $100,000 the year you receive it, and then if you do have to pay it back 3 years later, you can either take a deduction for the $100,000, assuming, again, anytime the amount's over $3,000, or you could get a credit that's computed based on the tax that you paid back 3 years ago when you got the $100,000 that was, in essence, that was greater than what you would have paid had that not been part of your income. In this case, the receiver, in this case, Rob Evans and Associates, was trying to get back that money because they were being forced to repay this to the various participants. And if they get that money back, they could repay more. Well, the trial court felt that this was okay, said that, you know, well, we understand, you know, trial court said, well, look, there is a basic problem we've got here. If you obtain funds by fraud and it's been, and we now have a prior trial that said they were obtained by fraud, then you have no reasonable expectation that you have unrestricted use of the funds. And if you don't have reasonable expectation of unrestricted use of the funds, you cannot use the claim of right doctrine. There are a series of cases that that bring this up. The court refers to the Cully case, the Kraft case, the McKinney case, all of which held that claim of right doesn't work, you know, unless if you obtained the funds by fraud because you didn't have an unrestricted right to the funds. But they said, but look, this is a special case. Congress couldn't have met this case because they didn't have an unrestricted right to the funds because they owed the funds back to these people that defrauded. And the receiver's trying to get the taxes back to give it to the people who were defrauded. So clearly, we shouldn't have the receiver tainted with the bad faith of the original entity. The First Circuit said, that all sounds wonderful, but it's not what the law says. In essence, Congress tailored a statute to iron out a wrinkle does not give, as the court said, the fact they tailored a statute to iron out a wrinkle in the code does not give a court license to make application of the statute wrinkle-free. That was their line in this case. They said the clear language of the statute requires us to find that when the funds were received, the receiver thought they had the party that received the funds, which was the those in control prior to the receiver, you know, had a reasonable expectation of unrestricted rights to the use of the funds. Since they didn't, the mere fact that the receiver is innocent of that doesn't change the fact that there still is not a right to use this provision of law. Effectively, if Congress doesn't like this sort of results, then this sort of thing Congress is going to have to change on its own. The courts cannot fix this one. Well, it's St. Patrick's Day week coming up, so hey, everybody's ready for the green, you know, and the one time a year green beer, that's always an interesting theory. But we'll have all of this going on. Hopefully you all enjoy your St. Patrick's Day. Also, spend some time if you do. You know, your state societies do have resources that are useful to you during tax season. Some of them are, you know, some of them are basically ways, you know, programs you get into and various deals that they have struck with other organizations to give you a member benefit for things you might be using quite a bit these days. You know, you may be using quite a bit of coffee these days. I don't know if anybody has a deal where coffee is cheaper, but if so, that'd be a really big one. If anybody's listening that can get that deal, we would love to have caffeine because we need that this time of year. But be sure to check in, see what your state society has. And remember, coming up in about a month or so, we're going to start getting those state society catalogs. We're going to be looking towards state society continuing education again for the coming year. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March 13, 2017. You can catch our regular updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also go there and on our weekly updates page, you will be able to download a PDF with the materials from this week's broadcast, so you can see the articles that we have there. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. And you can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter address is @edzollers. And we look forward. Next week, we'll be past our first due date and into that final month of tax season, which I know we all look forward to. So be sure to join us next week as we look at what's happened and what's going on as we move forward in the area of taxes.